Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 18th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Lana Dahlberg Landaverde, who is continuing her series on El Salvador. Today's session is number 2 and is titled The Faith and Struggle of Salvadoran Refugees. Let's listen in.
Right this time, the name of this class is the Salvadoran Refugees, and I want to focus more on today on the theme of suffering, spirit, and hope. And my name is Lana Dahlberg Landaverde, and you should start the tape. Okay, so the lesson I wanted to start with is, it was in our liturgy two nights ago, our evening service. It's from Romans, and if any of you have your Bibles with you, it's Romans 5, 3 through 5. And actually, I'll go ahead and start with 2. Therefore, since we have been justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ. Through him, we have obtained access to this grace in which we stand, and we rejoice in our hope of sharing the glory of God. But more than that, we rejoice in our sufferings, knowing that suffering produces endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope, and hope does not disappoint us, because God's love has been poured out into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. So as we look at the video today and then in our discussions, keep that in mind. Again, we were just discussing earlier the sense of community, and this passage also addresses the sense of community. It's plural. It's us. It's we who are suffering together in the hope, and with a very concrete hope of what we're trying to reach. And the sense of community where God's love is shared and compassion will come across in some of the stories that I'll read from the Salvadoran refugees. And then the importance of the presence of God through the Spirit, through the Comforter, the Helper, the Advocate is also extremely important. So I'm going to go ahead and start the video. And if someone can kind of down the lights over there, we'll get a sense of the Salvadoran refugees, and this video is mostly about their return after thousands of them had to flee into neighboring Honduras for refuge from military operations. So,
is this like 1991, 1992?
This is the returns, which began in 1986, and then from Honduras, they actually began in 1987. It gives the dates. But the first two go down. And the last one goes up, the one best, right?
Survivors of massacres and aerial bombardments carried out by the Salvadoran and Honduran militaries, the former refugees continue to live with the memory of war and a policy of repression against their newly repopulated communities. The decision to return home was not an easy one. The journey from Mesa Grande to El Salvador was difficult. It occurred in spite of sharp opposition by the Salvadoran government and armed forces, and with the staunch support of churches in El Salvador and the religious community in the United States. The refugees draw on their profound faith in God and in each other to make their dream of self-sufficiency and self-determination a reality. In response to an appeal from the Mesa Grande refugees, the Share Foundation and the Interfaith Office on Accompaniment, together with Salvadoran refugees and religious leaders from across the United States, launched the Going Home campaign. In October 1987, a national delegation of U.S. religious leaders accompanied the refugees to the Honduran border and delivered the resources needed to help make their move from Mesa Grande to El Salvador a success. With aid provided through Going Home, the Mesa Grande refugees have repopulated 4 sites in 3 rural provinces: Copapayo, Cuscatlan, Santa Marta, Cabañas, Guajila, and Las Vueltas in Chalatenango. In each of these communities, the land has been cleared of weeds and rubble left behind by the war. Men, women, and children work at building new homes, beginning with the homes of widows and people with disabilities. They plant the fields with their bare hands. Schools, health clinics, agricultural cooperatives, and community workshops have all been established. Health promoters treat common illnesses and educate the community about preventative health care. The former refugees join a broad repopulation movement in El Salvador. Today, thousands of Salvadorans struggle for their civil and human right to remain in villages such as Punch Milana and San Jose Las Flores, El Varillo, and Arcatao. The militarization of these communities makes life difficult. The Salvadoran government has not provided former refugees with the documents required to travel outside their villages for food and other supplies. International human rights advocates and church workers are frequently denied access to the repopulated sites, and trucks carrying church-sponsored humanitarian aid have been turned back by government military units.
The government wants us to leave, so they frighten us by bombing nearby fields and flying helicopters over our homes all night. Recently, they have enforced a policy of forced hunger by blocking food shipments and stealing our supplies.
Homes are illegally searched by the Salvadoran army. People are detained and interrogated without charge. Bombings and machine gunnings are carried out in and around these civilian communities. Even churches and international humanitarian aid agencies have been seriously harassed by the Salvadoran government, the military, and the U.S. Embassy for working with the repopulated communities. And yet, the people are determined to remain on the lands they know and love.
Peace is by planting our crops and demanding that our lives be respected. We want to reconstruct our homes and our farms and teach our children to work our land. We hope to rebuild our life in El Salvador so that our children can have a better future.
The repopulated communities remain hopeful. In Arcatao, 5,000 repopulators expressed their profound gratitude to a Going Home delegation delivering much-needed supplies to this isolated community. This was the first delegation to visit in 15 months. In Punch Milana, the repopulation sponsored by the Lutherans in El Salvador, the people inaugurated the new hope of Punch Milana, the church, and celebrated the achievements of the community. With the support of the Share Foundation, additional land has been purchased to grow food for the community. In 1988, the Salvadoran government demanded to meet with representatives from 9 repopulated communities to offer them government aid. In a unified response, the community representatives stated that they cannot accept assistance from the government until the issues of war and repression against innocent civilians are addressed. In a letter to the Share Foundation, Salvadoran Lutheran Bishop Medardo Gomez addressed the needs of the repopulated communities.
Cannot emphasize enough the need for your accompaniment at this critical moment when our people are working hard to return to their places of origin, to live in peace and with dignity. Your moral and material support enables us to live more freely and helps us move closer to the resurrection.
Going Home is committed to supporting the repopulated communities in their effort to remain on their lands despite government opposition. The campaign gives aid to the communities by supplying food, seeds, fertilizer, medicines, tools, and construction materials. Under a Let the Food Come In drive, organized by the Interfaith Office on Accompaniment, Going Home delegations are organizing a series of food convoys to break the government's policy of forced hunger. Individuals and faith communities from across the United States are responding to the call by supporting the Going Home campaign as an expression of their covenant with the people of El Salvador. After visiting the repopulated communities, Bishop Thomas Gumbleton of Detroit was struck by the determination of the people there.
I was profoundly moved by the courage of a people who live with a constant military threat. Seeing what they have built out of nothing is amazing. I'll do whatever needs to be done to help them stay home and rebuild their lives.
In a response to the appeal from the repopulated communities in El Salvador, Going Home is committed to raising $1 million by March 24, 1989, the 9th anniversary of the life and death of Archbishop Oscar Romero.
That's a campaign that's over, so I stopped it. I'm just going to flip the lights back on, and then we'll start with continuing with our presentation. I use this video because it does carry a sense of the refugees as they return to rebuild their communities. However, it was created for a specific purpose, which was to raise support for the rebuilding of their lives. And so that's why I kind of cut it off at that point, because it's from 1987 and we're almost a decade later still talking about this. What I wanted to do now is just, you've seen some images of the refugees. They originally fled their homelands, their home communities in the early 80s. 1980, 1981, 82, and I want to read a couple selections from two books that are in the bookstore. El Salvador Spring, whose well never runs dry, whose waters never run dry, and that's a collection of testimonies of Salvadoran refugees, and the other one is The Promised Land, Death and Life in El Salvador, is kind of like the memoirs or the recorded conversations that a lay missionary, North American, who was in El Salvador during those 10 years of conflict and war, and he spent a lot of time with the pastoral workers and in Bible studies, and so that's his collection of memoirs or his writings, his journal, some of his journal entries. So I'm going to read one entitled The Testimony of a Refugee, Exodus at the Sumpul River.
What would be the date on
this? This is written in July 1982, and the massacre actually took place in May of 1981. or 1980, it says, I'll read the introduction. The names of many places in El Salvador have a special meaning for the people because of the horrors committed there. One such place, the Simpul River, was the site of two large army massacres. The first occurred on May 14, 1980, when 600 men, women, and children were killed as they tried to flee across the river into Honduras. 2 years later, a second massacre took place, killing another 200 civilians. Tonya, a survivor of the second massacre, gave this testimony in a refugee camp in Honduras. She appeared tired and in poor health. Like many of the children, women, elderly in the camp, her feet were still soaked in blood. She held her baby in her arms as her husband stood beside her. It's not easy for me to talk. We've been walking for 9 days and nights, and I'm exhausted, but I'll try. We were fleeing from the military and had gathered to cross the Simpul River. There were about 5,000 of us, all civilians. No one was armed. Suddenly, soldiers attacked us. They were about 300 yards away when they started firing. We dropped everything we were carrying and ran. Children fell on top of each other, and adults stepped on children because everybody panicked. The man cleared a path through the bushes so that people could escape. We ran down the bank of the Simpul River and into the water. Some of the children were swept downstream. Many elderly people couldn't resist the current and drowned. Some women who had been shot in the legs could not run and were left behind. If God had not protected us, the whole community would have been killed. And in the midst of this terrible confusion, there was compassion. Some men helped the mothers to get their children across the river. Parents who had lost their own children carried children that were not their own. The chaos was terrifying. There was crying and shooting on all sides. Many people drowned. And then there was silence. Those of us who made it to the other side of the river kept running, but the gunfire followed us. Finally, we reached a hill and hid in the woods where we stayed for 2 days. The children cried from hunger. Some of them died because there was nothing to eat, and their mothers had no milk. We couldn't find anything to eat. When the babies cried, we became scared that the army would hear them and find us. Their mothers stuffed rags in the babies' mouths to stop the crying, and some of them suffocated to death. Others did not die right then, but the rags made their mouths so dry that they were unable to nurse. Other babies cried and cried because their mothers were not there. The following night, we all left. The army did not want us to escape. Their objective was to exterminate us so that not a single person would remain alive. We spent the whole night running. We ran for hours, from hill to hill, from ravine to ravine. When dawn came, we were still running. The elderly people could not go any further. The mothers were exhausted and the children too tired to cry. We were dying of hunger and thirst. At first, we had some green mangoes and cactus leaves. But later, we did not have time to even scavenge for food. The enemy finally located us. They flew overhead in helicopters and shouted at us, "Guerrillas, we are the Belloso Battalion." They shot at us and dropped bombs and threw grenades. Bullets rained down on us from all sides. Many people were killed. It was a miracle of God that we survived. God saved us in order to show the enemy that they are not all powerful. Fortunately, with God's help, we found the rest of our community. We joined them and escaped through a ravine. We cried and cried for all those who had been killed. There was no food to eat. We ate raw corn, roots, and leaves. We made soup out of grass and leaves. After that, there was nothing. Some of us had not eaten for 9 days, others for 12 days. But thanks to the great power of God, the Spirit who guided us, we are still alive. I remember what the people of Israel experienced when Pharaoh pursued them in order to exterminate them. We know their experience. And this is some reflecting on those experiences by the refugees themselves. 9 months have passed since that river crossing, since the river Lempa River crossing. Again, this is that second massacre. There are three refugee camps now called campamentos, which are spread along the edge of the town called La Virtud in Honduras. More than 3,500 Salvadoran refugees live here now in primitive tent shelters with hot canvas roofs. Another 5,000 refugees live in the different hamlets surrounding the town. Today is the beginning of Advent. Lina, one of the catechists in the camps, told me today that he left his home in the village of Santa Marta exactly 1 year ago during an invasion by the Salvadoran army. "I have learned one thing," he said. "If we don't pass through this suffering, we will never understand the gospel." Lina's hope, like the hope of all the refugees, is born in the crucible of violence, blood, and death. His hope is the hope of a people in exile, to return one day to his native land, El Salvador. Tonight, another group of refugees arrived in the rain, mostly women and children. Family by family, they make their way down the mountainside in the dark to the camp below. Like each new wave of refugees, their stories are tragic. They have been in flight for 16 days, fleeing still another invasion of their village by the Salvadoran military. Exposed to the rains with nothing to eat, their faces are weary, their feet bare and bleeding. Only a flaming torch, a fire-lit stalk of corn, lights their way into the camp, illuminating their faces and the hope expressed so well by the Advent readings. The Lord will not be silent about Jerusalem until her integrity shines out like the dawn and her salvation flames like a torch. That's a reading from Isaiah 62:1. Tonight in our campamento, in the refugee camp, a light shines in the darkness. The next day, the catechists got together and read from the prophet Isaiah, "Console my people, console them," Isaiah 40:1. The situation of the refugees is strikingly similar to the exile in the time of Isaiah. The refugees yearn to hear a message of hope, just like the people of Israel, and prepare the way for their return to El Salvador. Like the message of John the Baptist in the wilderness, this hope is prophetic, inviting the people to prepare the way for the coming of the Lord in this time of exile. "Let every valley be filled in, and every mountain and hill be laid low," Isaiah 44. The prophetic word can make a way out of no way, creating new options that open paths of salvation in history. The Lord saves people in history with unexpected historical possibilities. Not only do the words of the prophet illuminate the dramatic situation of the refugees on the border, their suffering provides fertile soil for the message to take root and blossom with hope. When new refugees reach the camps after fleeing for days in the mountains from the Salvadoran military, their feet swollen and bare, there is a great outpouring of grief, but also of compassion and amazement. "Milagro," the people say. It's a miracle, a sign of God's favor. The suffering of the people is profound. Their struggle is much like the dramatic struggle to be born that is recounted in the story of Advent. The flight from the repression, the struggle to find shelter, the slaughter of innocent children. But the faith of the people and their ability to resist are even more profound. They have a deep faith that God is accompanying them in times of distress and giving them strength to resist. "We will prevail," Lino said, "because we know how to suffer." These two things, the flight of the people, the terror, persecution, repression, and resulting exile, and their struggle and hope for liberation, profoundly mark the experience of the refugees. The more devastating the experience of exile and suffering, the more profound the hope of liberation, a definitive liberation that touches on all aspects of life, social and economic transformation, political participation, and a deepening of one's faith and commitment to the people. It is as though a veil has been lifted. A people who have literally walked through the darkness of ignorance, domination, humiliation, and repression are now awakening to a new hope, that breaks through this veil like a bright flash of light. So I'll just open with a few comments, then we can hear from other people. What I saw in the reading from Romans, and again in these readings of the refugees' experience, is that they learned to seek God's face in that suffering, to believe that God was present, to know, and to a belief that is more of a visceral knowing that God is with them. And hearing the word, because many of them are illiterate, and God's promises through the words, they take that to heart, that God is with us. As I said, it's a sign of God's favor that we are suffering this. In another of the selections, one of the catechists says, we should be proud that we are refugees, because Jesus was a refugee. He was born poor among us and born in a stable. And the fact that we are refugees means that God has shown favor on us. God is with us. God has chosen us. So again, the word making that real in people's lives, taking to heart God's promises, and then claiming their baptism. Again, the theme of this summer, Holden, is baptism. Claiming that they are God's children. And I'm thinking of last night, the presentation by Dan Erlander, that in The Little Princess, the little girl draws a circle and stands inside that. And even though they've stripped her of all of her dignity, of all that she had, she can stand in that circle and say, I am a princess. In the same way, he said, we can stand within this promise and say that we are a precious child, a precious children of God. So I feel like even in the midst of that suffering, just knowing that God is with them, that God is blessing them, instead of certainly for many of us, it would have been easy to dwell on all the terrible things and ask the questions, why? Why has my child just been killed? Why God, why are you punishing me, or why? And not to say that people didn't have those questions, but somehow just as a community to hold together and believe that yes, God is with us. God has saved us and brought us across this river. That has always struck me, that they've held to that promise. And maybe the sense of community, as the reading mentioned, that somehow they were able to maintain that remnant or that fragment of the community together. And having that responsibility to care for others in the community, to care for somebody else's child when that person has been killed. And somehow that keeps the hope alive, too, that there's a story that that in one of these long, what they called long guindas, which is like a term of like running from the military, and they would literally run days, they would run at night under the cover of darkness, several nights at a time, 5, 6, 7 nights, and in the case of one of these long flights, they saw that an old, they tell the story of an elderly man who just wanted to lie down and die. But a mother said, would you please carry my child? And I can no longer, I have no more strength to be carrying him. And the elderly man who wanted to lie down and die now had to carry a newborn into that hope of new life, or that hope of exile, of being away from this situation of terror. And that gave him the strength to continue on, that sense of responsibility to that other, to the other. So I see it all as interlinked, as community, as people responsible to each other, members of all members of the body of Christ, we're all children of God, that somehow that we can, I saw in them that they could pull together through that suffering to try to realize the hope that kept them going into exile, and then, as we saw in the slides, the hope to be able to return and to rebuild in their communities. So that briefly was just, that was what I wanted to share, and then maybe open it up for comments or questions, discussion.
I was thinking of the lady who spoke this morning about the loss of hope through struggle in Chicago. Mm-hmm. It seems like you've got a dichotomy, because what makes one group or person get hope out of suffering and the other loses all hope because of suffering, it seems like it's almost a gift that, and you're still going back to, what's that book that came out years ago, Why Do the Bad Things Happen to Good People? I teach English as a second language, and so many of my students in the 10 years ago at least were refugees. And I would see some of them who had great hope, and some of them had absolutely no hope, or the only hope they had is sometimes, could we ever go back? But it doesn't affect everybody the same way, I guess. Yeah. I don't even know the answer of why. I guess I don't want to say that God gives this gift of hope to some people, not to this group.
I don't have an answer for that. I do know there were stories of like one older man who in a bombing was essentially knocked unconscious by the force of the bombing. Again, these are 500-pound bombs or 250-pound bombs. And when he woke up, when he came to, he realized his entire family had been wiped out. And this is someone that my husband, who's Salvadoran, met in this situation. And he told my husband, you know, how can I believe in a God anymore? My entire family is just wiped out. I have no one. So I don't know. Again, it's the gift of faith. Yeah. And somehow hope is linked up with that. I don't know if someone else has a response. Like, some of us were here this morning. We heard the woman who said in Chicago, the deep hopelessness that sometimes you find in the inner city, even a woman of great faith, after years and seeing the drug addiction and the children kind of gunned down by the violence in the inner city.
Sometimes it's a process, though, I think. I work with severely disturbed adults who have just horrendous childhood histories, and one of the things we struggle with is often is what happened to them spiritually as they were going through their trauma. Mm-hmm. And what I see, and as you've been talking, and I think of the Oklahoma City bombing and how people responded differently, how they might feel and where their faith is one day may be very different from a month from then or a year from then.
Mm-hmm.
There's something in my mind that is not well formulated, but seems clear somewhere inside myself. The presence of God, which is very real to me, comes through differently in different situations for me. There's kind of an equation, like what God is, that acts as a self-correcting thing in my life. Like, God is love is a very, very powerful part of my sense of who God is. And God is truth, and God is peace, and, you know, and these other kinds of things. But in this situation of suffering, you know, when we start asking ourselves or asking about other people, why is it that some people are destroyed by suffering and other people are deepened and enriched? Why is it that some people are destroyed by what we would call blessing, you know, great riches and great security in life, and other people somehow or other are able to survive that and use that to give blessing to others? I think somehow It's the presence of God experienced as love, which at the same time is responsibility in love. And it's somehow the people who come through it have been able to experience God as love, and at that point then they need to love their own life in order to continue it and see it as a possible blessing to others, to themselves in the future, like the old man who was asked to carry the infant. I think it would only be God as love that gives the impulse to give what's left of his life to to this new life to bring it along. And so it seems to me that the presence of God as love is a big dynamic in that. Which way does does it go toward bitterness and revenge, or does it go toward peace? And I
guess that's really clear in the text from Romans too. It does say, not too many passages marked off here, but again, the when it talks about suffering producing character and character producing hope, and then it says the hope does not disappoint us because God's love has been poured into our hearts through the Holy Spirit, which has been given to us. So again, it's experiencing of God's love through the presence of the Spirit that some people maybe are able to grasp that. And the sense of the responsibility of then of loving others, of compassion, of helping others, that enables people to keep that love, to keep that hope alive.
As you've been in El Salvador, what have you observed of the people as they resettle and get about the business of establishing homes again and their farms and facing all of that?
What's it like 10 years later?
Yeah. That's a good question. The war ended in 1991 with the signing of peace accords by both FMLN and the government. And since that time, the Lutheran Bishop Menardo Gomez uses one insight from the passage about the 10 lepers to kind of describe what he sees happening, where you have Jesus, the 10 lepers are together when they approach Jesus to be healed. And Jesus heals the 10 lepers. And what we remember from that text is that nine of which went their own way, and only one came back to give thanks. But what Bishop Gomez pointed out about that text is that essentially all 10 then went away from each other. They were no longer a community. What united them was their common illness as lepers. And during the war, what united people and gave them a definitive hope was that they were being repressed by the government and the military, and they had to seek exile, and that someday they were going to return, rebuild, and that it would be a new country, or at least they would have the basics. People really believed that they would have the basics once the war was over, not only in terms of not being living in fear and in persecution, but having basic sustenance for their children and shelter. And so folks were united to reach that common goal, and many of them were supporters of, in these areas, because they were bombed by the government, they were supporters of the insurgency, the FMLN, with the hopes that, yes, the FMLN did say, well, we are here for the poor. And with the signing of the peace accords and kind of and you negotiate a settlement to the war, that sense of a common goal or a common something that united them, which was their all being under repression and seeking to overcome that repression and create a new society, that kind of dispersed. And so Bishop Gomez used that particular parable or that particular passage as a parable, saying that now even the churches, there's divisions among the churches, there's divisions in society in general. Is kind of a post-war phenomena. Now that the war is over and the common goal, which was to end the war, is no longer at hand, there's a lot of social disorganization. And during the war, you saw communities very closely knitted, working together. And now after the war, it's like, well, there's like a the light at the end of the tunnel, and when you finally get there and it's not quite the light that you hoped for, it's a big letdown. So it's been a very hard, since 1991, it's been a very hard transition. And these communities started to go back and rebuild in the late 80s. The video mentioned 1987 was when the refugees from Mesa Grande, the United Nations camp in Honduras, started to go back. And they rebuilt, and again, they were going back during the middle of the war, so they stayed together. There's even one story of when the military came into one community called Guajila, and they tried to capture young man, all the mothers in that community went and put their hands on that young man, kind of formed a human barricade. And even though they were unarmed, and the soldiers, of course, were armed, they were able to effectively keep the military from taking away one of their members because they were united. And so there was that sense during the war, and they rebuilt their communities, and there was a lot of international aid coming in from churches, Lutheran World Federation, Catholic Relief Services. Again, partly just because of the war and the great suffering of the people, the relief aid poured in. And now that is over, and people are still poor, and it's not, the economy is very, very bad. I think it's like a big stumbling block. It's shaking that hope. It's really shaking that hope at the level of the foundation of people really believe things would be different.
And does not the persecution and the fear still remain in? This is some of the information that I get.
But I think it's a lot more subtle.
Yeah.
And so you don't know where it's going to come from in a way. I mentioned yesterday there was a Presbyterian pastor who's working with the Lutheran Church in El Salvador, who's actually a Salvadoran national, but he went to seminary here in the United States and I think is also a citizen of the United States, got political asylum here, and then went back to serve as a missionary in El Salvador. And he was apprehended and his assailants asked his name and then shot him in the face. Mm-hmm. And he miraculously survived. And I had a chance to talk with him last week. He's back in the Bay Area, and then he'll be going up, I guess the national headquarters of the Presbyterian Church is in Louisville, Kentucky. He'll be going there. But he wasn't quite sure if it was death squads or, you know, who had... Mm-hmm. But he said, you know, that there is a lot of... Unfortunately, some people in the community had taken advantage of other people in the community, had gotten, in terms of the land transfer program, had gotten people to trust that when they formed a cooperative that the lands that would be transferred over would be titled over in that person's name. And so this one person has acquired a great deal of land by the trust of the other people. Because he was someone that was, during the war years, that people trusted. And it's really sad to see that happening. So he doesn't know whether it was death squads that killed him, or attempted to kill him, or whether it was, possibility of this person in the community who'd been acquiring land that he'd spoken out against. And but there is definitely persecution, and the death squads are still intact. And a lot of them have turned to organized crime, so it's not so clear-cut. They might actually be kidnapping members of the wealthy because that's more lucrative to kidnap family member of a very wealthy person, get a good ransom, than it is to rob the poor because the poor don't have much to take. But when you come to very highly political moments like the elections, in the 94 elections we saw a number of political assassinations, they still are operative. So people live in fear, and they live in fear of what could be common crime or distrust, or are still careful about what they say. I don't know if that answers your question, but...
One of the things about the business of suffering, and as you're thinking about that, it has to have meaning. And if it doesn't have any meaning, then it's hopeless. And, you know, the lady in Chicago, my sense is that her suffering had meaning when she was trying to rear her 13 kids to get out. And the system ate them. Mm-hmm. And then they ate themselves, self-destructively. And so she has faith, but she doesn't have any hope because there's no meaning. It's meaningless. Whereas these people who have an enemy, these people who, you know, the martyrs flag the zeal of the cause. Mm-hmm. Viktor Frankl, when he was in the Jewish psychiatrist, when he was in the concentration camp, talks about the only way that people survived was they constructed meaning out of this suffering, mm-hmm. out of this insanity. And somehow we have to, I mean, I need to reach for that. We all need to reach for that. Whether it's cancer, mental illness, or, mm-hmm. you know, what is the meaning of this endeavor? And I think that people who lose a sense of meaning lose a sense of hope. Mm. To me, the cross is the yoke, you know, the cross and the suffering of God gives it meaning. Now, one other thing I was thinking about is that there is no peace without justice. I wonder if this El Salvador is building for another revolution because of the disappointment of the fact that the light at the end of the tunnel was a flashlight and not this huge train that was going to carry him to the promised land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you get people who've lost a great deal, the payoff is very disappointing. The next generation could be really angry about that and say, they didn't do it last time, we'll do it this time. Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think there's a ferment for revolution in the next generation?
I think the peace accord is kind of the weakest area of the peace accords. There was 100 different agreements. The weakest, most of them really focused on the what they call the demilitarization of the society, getting rid of the infamous security forces which were killing off people and reducing the army by half, and then of course getting the FMLN to demobilize and destroy its weapons. And that was a very successful, the greatest success of that set of peace agreements was demilitarizing the society in that way. The part that was the weakest, and again, this is the two belligerent forces who were negotiating in this, the FMLN, essentially decided that the government was not willing to, but government played hardball on the area of economic reforms and economic opportunities, which of course were the root causes of the war. And so those are that's the whole set of agreements that's the weakest, really, is, I mean, they're making some progress on the political reforms, the constitutional reforms, the judicial, reforming the judicial system, creating a new civilian police force. Those have all made some progress. Where it's really weak is all the set of agreements dealing with workers' rights and then for rural people, the land transfer program and programs which, and the reinsertion programs for the ex-combatants of either side of the army or the FMLN. And that's the worrisome part, because if you don't address the root causes of the war, as you're saying, then a generation or two generations later, are you going to have a revolt again? Because the unequal distribution of wealth was never really addressed and was not really kind of... with the land transfer program, I say it was redistributed a little bit. I forget the percentage, but there's now another... Oh, I'm so bad with percentages and numbers. Instead of 2% of the land, people owning 40%, 60% of the land, it became more like now it's back down to 2% owning 40% or something like that. It was slightly redistributed because there was 50,000 people who became beneficiaries of the land transfer program, enabling them to a 30-year mortgage on maybe somewhere between 5 and 8 acres of land. The problem is if we don't share the foundation that I work with, what we're looking at is how can that be sustainable? How can people hang on to that land? Most of these 50,000 beneficiaries who are these refugees in the film that we saw, they people who lived in those conflicted areas whose homes were bombed, or the people who are combatants, or the people who are beneficiaries of this program. And they, many of them have a home, a very small home that's also financed. And then they have the land that's been financed with a mortgage. And then they have, every year in order to grow crops, they have to usually take out a small loan to get the seed and the fertilizer. And so they're already heavily into debt. And so how do you enable them to hang on to this land when that was probably, if they take any future loans, the security for those loans is the land. And that's what we're working on is, this just for 2 years been really been pressuring for this debt to be, there's a history in El Salvador for the debt to be pardoned. In fact, many of the loans that the huge coffee barons took out in the 80s when the banks were privatized, many of these banks were national banks in the 80s, and then they became privatized in the late 80s, 1989. A lot of their loans were essentially forgiven or pardoned. And so you have people who are very wealthy who had huge outstanding loans. When the banks were privatized, the state essentially absorbed those debts so that the new private banks would be solvent and healthy institutions. And so after a lot of pressure, we have achieved the government's in the Congress of El Salvador, the National Legislative Assembly passed a decree pardoning 70% of those debts, of the land debt that these people have, and not just peasants that got land at this recent land transfer program through the Peace Accords, but the agrarian reform cooperatives, which got land through agrarian reforms in the early 80s. Though they have 70% of their debt pardoned, but they have essentially 1 year to pay off the remaining 30%. And so that's our struggle now as to how to either extend that window, because their debt currently is with a state-owned bank, which has more favorable interest rates and terms than a commercial bank. And the commercial bank, if they have to go to a commercial bank to pay off or to take out a loan for the remaining 30% that they owe, then there is a possibility of foreclosure. And so this is kind of what we're working with, is how can they hang on to this land? And the other thing the peace agreements were supposed to do was give them training and new techniques. And we're trying to help them. And we'll talk more about this on Wednesday. And I'll be talking about sustainable development. We're helping to train cooperatives and people, beneficiaries of this land transfer program, in organic farming, so they're not reliant on these loans that pretty much stipulate that you use certain pesticides and insecticides, and certain fertilizers, but that they begin to have more sustainable means of growing their crops and diversifying their crops so they can sell them on the market nationally, on the national market or on the international market. And we're trying to provide them training so that many of them are illiterate, just learning how to run as a cooperative, run an agricultural business, how to keep good accounting records. Because that, again, is trying to help raise them to another level where they can hang on to their land, they can compete. Unfortunately, they have to compete in this global economy that's...
Do they sell their food, like, to each other, or do they actually export their crops are? How does that happen?
Most of these people, what they'll do is they'll grow what they need, that they know they need to survive, which is they'll grow their corn and their beans. But again, they have a mortgage on that land, so the corn and beans, which they can use to feed their families, is not going to make a profit. So the idea is to help them diversify, and then what we do have in practice is... We're focusing on one area of the country to really try to help them develop some crops. One of them is in San Vicente. We have cooperatives growing cashew trees because that's something that has grown very well in that area. And then if they're certified as organic, then there's a much better price on the international market. And they are able to sell to a cooperatively owned kind of processing plant for cashews that then exports to, I know of at least one importer here in the United States called Earth Trades that buys them at favorable rates for the cooperatives. And so that there is a market, but they also need to develop national markets, so we're helping them grow plantains for this next cycle, plantain trees, or plátano as they call it in Spanish, which are those big bananas that you can eat fried, and then papaya. And then trying to help them sell that on the national market, because a lot of their fruit comes from Guatemala. And so hopefully with organic, where they're not spending much money on fertilizers and on pesticides, if they can kind of learn the organic methods and make that investment time and learning those procedures, then hopefully they can actually get some returns and they can make enough to pay their mortgages on that, or even if it's a small mortgage, if it's 30%, make enough to pay it and still be able to have their corn and their beans to feed their families. That's the hope. That's what we're trying to do, is help them to stay on the land.
Do you ever fear that that they'll run out of time before enough change is made that they just won't?
Gotta have hope. I guess it's, you know, we're working with a very small segment of the population, so it's not even the vast majority of these people. And, you know, we're working with maybe 15% of those beneficiaries, really trying to help them to get it together so they can serve as a model or example for the others. Yeah, and it seems pretty dismal, I guess, in light of, like we were talking earlier about the global economy is just such that it's these international corporations that really pretty much dominate, even for the agricultural sector, whether they're going to buy your produce or not. And it's very hard to make it as a small farmer anywhere in the world.
What is the population of South Africa?
The population is 5 million, so it's not a huge country. It's a very tiny country, and geographically it's about the size of Massachusetts. So they don't even have much land. I mean, there's a very dense population, and you know, as the population continues to grow, it's draining the resources of the land. The soil is pretty much it's been so deforested that the erosion every year is making the soil just less and less fertile. It's carrying away all the topsoil, and again, that's why they resort to the chemicals. But that's not sustainable. There's a lot of challenges, and I guess it's very easy just to get totally depressed about it and say there's just no hope. But again, that's the challenge, that's the call, is to have hope and to work with people and to believe that something can happen, that there can be dignified life for all people.
You know what the inflation rate is there?
It's stabilized, but I think it's like 18%.
Excuse me, 18% what?
Inflation. It's,
whoa.
Yeah. It's more stable than in the past. In the past it was higher, but they pegged the cologne, which is the national currency, to the dollar, so it's a little bit more stable.
Is there education, government control or subsidized, or how is the education set up, per se?
The public education is very poor. I think it receives like 2% of the national budget. It's just, I think health and education receives just something like, you know, under 5% of the national budget. It's just very, very poor care.
That's what's going to make such a difference for this next generation, to get better
education. Well, it's very unfortunate. The government's economic strategy, and with this, I guess I should finish because we'll talk more about this on Wednesday morning. The government's strategy is to really provide more employment by opening up more free trade zones for these international sweatshop companies to come in, the maquilas. And essentially, those companies do not put anything back into the country. They don't pay any taxes. They do provide about 30 to 40,000 jobs in El Salvador, and it's growing annually. But again, it's almost slave labor conditions. Young women working 12, 16-hour days, and in sweatshops essentially, and nothing goes into schooling, nothing. And if that's the government strategy for its maintaining its income, it's by having these companies come in, then it's going to become worse and worse. So I guess we're at time, essentially. We're a little bit over. So tomorrow we'll be talking about martyrdom in El Salvador, and again, coming back to to what you were saying about the suffering having meaning. The martyrs provide that sense of meaning and that knowledge that God is with them, because the martyrs that have died have not died in vain. They make meaning. They create a meaning out of the suffering. And so that's tomorrow's session. And I had some readings. So I guess I just really encourage you to get these books. The readings for tomorrow are in this book, basically the hundreds. There's a section on the martyrs in page 99 on in the Promised Land book. So I encourage you to get that. And of course, we'll be talking about Archbishop Romero, who was killed in 1980, and many other Salvadorans who've been killed. So thank you for coming.